This edition of Monocle on Saturday was first broadcast on the 4th of May, 2024. I'm Georgina Godwin, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. This is Monocle on Saturday. Coming up on today's programme, we'll have a look through the week's news and culture with Charles Hecker, the political analyst and author of a forthcoming book, Zero Sum. Then we'll speak to the founder of Galley Beggar Press to find out how much it really costs to print a book. First, though, here's the news. China has launched an uncrewed spacecraft on a mission to retrieve rocks and soil from the far side of the moon, the first country to make such an ambitious attempt. Besides uncovering new information about the celestial body closest to Earth, the mission is part of a long-term project to build a permanent research station on the moon, the China and Russia-led International Lunar Research Station. Hope Hicks, a former top aide to Donald Trump, testified on Friday that he told her in the final days of the 2016 presidential election to deny that he had a sexual relationship with porn star Stormy Daniels. Prosecutors in the first criminal trial of a former US president argue that the payment to Daniels corrupted the election by suppressing news that could have influenced voters as they decided whether to back the Republican Trump or Hillary Clinton, then his Democratic rival. And Eurovision celebrations kick off in Sweden's third city, Malmö, today, with the first rounds beginning on Tuesday. However, planned protests against Israel taking part in this year's contest have made members of the Jewish community there anxious and prompted an Israeli warning against travelling to the event. The Israeli military said its Home Front Command mobile phone app will provide real-time notifications with any emergency instructions for Israelis in Malmö throughout the contest. And that's your Monocle Radio News. Hello and welcome to Monocle on Saturday. I'm Georgina Godwin and I'm joined in the studio by Charles Hecker, political analyst and author of the forthcoming book Zero Sum about international business in Russia. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, you'll notice in the headlines what I didn't mention was the elections, the by-elections and the more particularly the mayoral elections here, particularly for London, because we don't know the result.
That's right. Counting continues as we speak in what is an unexpectedly, perhaps, close race for the mayor of London, in which incumbent Sadiq Khan is running for his third successive term against the Tory candidate Susan Hall, who, was not necessarily put up as a very serious candidate. She has some fairly far-right views, very little governing experience, not much in the way of a platform for promoting London against a two-term incumbent. But the results are late. And with every sort of increasing hour, what we see in the papers covering the count is that Labour is becoming increasingly nervous. Mm. The primary factor here is turnout, and that is that turnout in London mayoral elections historically is quite low. And if it's hovering, as it currently looks to be, around 40%, that might spell trouble for the Labour candidate.
Now, I was reading that actually turnout from the outer boroughs of London has been much higher than normal. And judging by what our taxi drivers have been saying to us in the last few days, that's because a lot of cab drivers do live out there. And that's because people are very, very angry about ULEZ, which is the ultra low emission zone, which Sadiq Khan, who is running for his third term, introduced. And particularly people who drive for a living are very anti this.
That's right. Sadiq Khan's signature policy, or at least one of them, is air quality and the cleanliness of London's air. In fact, I believe it was last year he published a book on clean air and its effect on health, and particularly on children's health and on lung and respiratory health. And he's really sort of nailed his colors to the post with clean air. And for every driver in London who has to now pay more money if they drive into an ultra low emissions zone, he has gained an enemy. And he has gained a vote against him. And as we know, taxi drivers tend to vote quite actively. They tend to vote in blocks. They tend to be courted by incumbents and rivals alike. And exactly as you suggest, this is a constituency that on this very issue has probably turned against him.
I mean, I had to give up my car. but I'm not possibly saying who I'd vote for, but I will say that my dog, she's a Springer Spaniel for Sadiq.
Does she get to vote four times, one for each paw?
but this has big implications for the Conservatives and for Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister.
That's right. So technically speaking, these were local elections. These were elections for things like mayor and for city council and for police commissioner and for various local level offices, with the exception of one by-election for a seat in Westminster, which did go to Labour. But in spite of the fact that these were local elections, this has always and only really ever been a referendum on the Prime Minister, a referendum on the Tories, and a forecast of their potential results in a general election that has yet to be announced. And by every count, with the exception of what may or may not happen in London, by every count, the Tories have taken a major pasting in this election. I mean, the Labour has a net gain of more than 200 seats, and the Conservative Party has a net loss of more than 370 seats across all of the contested precincts. And Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, has survived a vote of no confidence, perhaps, or an attempt to remove him, really by the narrowest of margins. There were three metrics for keeping him in office after these disastrous results. And one of them went his way, and that was the survival of the mayor in
Tees Valley.
In Tees Valley, that's right, Ben Houchen, who won re-election. And if it hadn't gone that way, then the Tories would have confronted an even more difficult election, and that would have been casting ballots for whether they wanted to get rid of Rishi Sunak. Mm.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating because we are looking at a complete sea change here in Britain, I think.
Well, you know, the Conservatives have been in power for now coming up on 14 years. And, you know, you have to say that whether we're talking about the UK elections, I mean, just for a bit of broader perspective here, whether we're talking about the UK elections or we're talking about any other, democratic function, political systems, political parties, and certainly legislative bodies really depend on fresh blood. And without that, things tend to stagnate and stall. And really what's happened here in the UK over the 13 or 14 years of Conservative Party rule is a party that has essentially run out of gas. Mm-hmm. And I say this without any sort of partisan influence or anything like that. But, you know, they're now on their, hold on, let me count, one, two, three, is it third prime minister? Two of which have been appointed without a general election. They have had to, for a foreign secretary, reach deep into the archives of Conservative Party history to find somebody who was willing to represent the interests of the United Kingdom abroad in David Cameron, literally because there was no one else to pick. And they've just run out of, you know, the ideas that they've put together, their 5-point flat platform on things like inflation and stopping the boats and all of the rest of that manifesto has really run out of gas.
Absolutely. I suppose the worry is, though, that when Labour win, because I'm quite sure that they will in the general election, we must have patience with them. They are inheriting this absolute. I mean, it's not the country's not in a great place, and that's not something that can be fixed overnight.
This is the potential threat to a Labour Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, and to a Starmer administration, and this is a potential risk in the political cycle and the way this works, and that is that for Labour to enact a manifesto, for Labour to sort of right some of the wrongs and correct some of the tendencies and the trends that have manifest under the Tories, they may have to do some very, very unpopular, undertake some very unpopular measures in the very beginning of their term, and that will lose them the goodwill that usually accompanies what will be probably an absolute stomping Labour victory. There'll be a honeymoon period. There'll be goodwill. They will have to spend that very quickly and will run the risk of becoming very unpopular.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, we don't know when the election is. We haven't been given a date. And one of the worries is, and many articles written on this, is that it will coincide or nearly coincide with the American elections, which people say could could be a global threat because neither Britain nor America will be concentrating on the rest of the world. Not that actually Britain is that important any longer when it comes to the rest of the world. But of course, the US elections could yet be upturned too with Trump's trial.
That's right. So we're going to turn now to some of the coverage of one of the more recent sort of blockbuster developments in the Trump re-election campaign. And I do say re-election not because he's running as an incumbent, certainly, but because he's, incumbent minus one and is running to return to the White House. But before he does that, he's got to get out of a New York courtroom unscathed. And Hope Hicks, who is one of his closest advisors, was one of his closest advisors, took the stand yesterday for the prosecution under duress. She was compelled to testify by the prosecution. She did not appear in court voluntarily. She is somebody with a long history inside the Trump administration and the Trump organization. And in fact, she once worked in public relations for Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter. She then became an extremely high-profile representative and spokesperson for the Trump administration in the White House. They had a big falling out because she did turn on the president over the events of January 6th, 2017, where she sort of thought this was something that was a bad idea and should not have happened. And the president unceremoniously sort of dumped her as a friend. She was in court yesterday and the defense was trying to do two things. The first thing that they were trying to do is to say that the payment of $130,000 to Stormy Daniels was directly tied to concerns about the election. And so that, in the juror's mind, means that this was something done to manipulate the outcome of a presidential election. And she actually did that quite convincingly. What the defense tried to do, though, was to say that this all happened because Michael Cohen had a sort of a harebrained scheme and the president had nothing to do with it. And so there will be more testimony forthcoming from Hope Hicks. There is yet an entire bandwagon of bold-faced names to testify in this trial. The president runs the risk of serving up to 4 years in jail. And also not only just being the first presidential candidate to undergo a criminal trial, but perhaps to be the first acting candidate with a criminal conviction.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So many speculative pieces written about what would happen if he did go down.
Well, there was a really interesting piece about if the president is convicted and if the president goes to jail, the former president. It is tradition, by the way, in American sort of parlance to always refer to former presidents as the president. If he goes to jail, the Secret Service has to go with him. And so some poor unfortunate sort of Secret Service agents, it is American policy to protect former presidents until they are no longer with us. Some of them will have to take up sort of light housekeeping in a federal prison if President Trump goes to jail. No, this is completely uncharted territory and nobody knows what will happen if he's convicted, whether he'll serve and what happens to his candidacy if he does have a conviction to his name. What he's turned this into, of course, is a massive victimization campaign, that he is subject of a witch hunt and that this has helped galvanize some of the support amongst his base who feel that he's been done wrong.
Absolutely. And tell me, what's not really coming out in any of these cases against him is the idea of some kind of connection with Russia.
Right. This has already been litigated both in official investigations, the Robert Mueller investigation, when Robert Mueller was running the FBI. No, he was former the head of the FBI. He ran this investigation as a special outside counsel. And, you know, the links between President Trump and Russia in the campaign have been established. There was somebody from Russia who approached Donald Trump Jr. With dirt on Hillary Clinton. And he said, if this is true, I'm loving it. You know, that famous quote from way back when. President Putin has announced that he would prefer to see Joe Biden win the upcoming election. Now, this may be a little bit of sort of reverse psychology and reverse propaganda saying that, oh, well, if the president of a country that's currently waging a war of aggression against Ukraine is in favor of the incumbent, then maybe we better vote for somebody else. So, you know, Russia will influence – Russia clearly influences elections around the world. There was clearly a disinformation campaign in connection with the 2016 election, and there will be another one for the 2024 November elections. It is already underway. Americans and the Brits, in fact, this has already been mentioned in the run-up to the anticipated general election, the role that misinformation and AI and deep fakes are going to play in these elections. And Russia is a major manufacturer of this particularly noxious brand of misinformation.
And of course, this is your USP. You're a Russia expert. Your book, Zero Sum, is about Russian business.
That's right. Zero Sum is about the last 30 years of international business in Russia and what has turned out to be essentially one of the greatest experiments in the history of global trade. And that was the rushing in to the Russian market when it opened in 1991 and the rushing out of the Russian market when it began to close in a very messy and incomplete way after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022.
Charles, as I'm afraid you're about to find out, writing books doesn't necessarily make you a fortune.
Sadly, I've been warned of that in advance. Hope springs eternal.
Yeah. Well, now in another installment of our occasional series where we take a tour of the world's independent bookshops and publishers, we check in with Galley Beggar Press, based in Norwich, England. It aims to support writers of great literary talent who push the boundaries of form and language. Unfortunately, however, the increasing production and distribution costs are making it harder for smaller presses to support such writers. Well, joining me now to tell us more about Galley Beggar Press and the pressures on small publishers is its co-founder, Sam Jordison. Hello to you, Sam.
Hi there.
You've got some stunning authors on your list. You published Lucy Ellman, Ducks Newburyport, Pretty Tunisia, We That Are Young, Emma McBride, A Girl Is a Half-Formed Thing. I mean, just fabulous books that won huge, huge prizes. Take me back to the beginning, because you only started in 2012.
Yeah, that is correct. We started in 2012. There are two of us, essentially myself and my co-director and wife, Eloise Miller. And you've described very generously what we aim to do. And, you know, that was our aim from the start. We wanted to support writers of real talent. And we thought at the time, you know, that wasn't necessarily happening in the way we wanted to see it. So we got going with those principles and we were very lucky, and we've always been very lucky. So it's quite strange to be here complaining in a way, because I'm also very conscious we've had wonderful luck with our writers who have won these prizes and done so well and, you know, really become famous around the world, and with our readers who have supported us through these more than 10 years now. We've had fantastic people who subscribe to our books, buy them in advance, and have done all kinds of generous things for us. So it's mainly a story of actual good fortune and a lot of fun, because we love these books.
Mm-hmm. I am very interested in this breakdown you've published of production costs and profit margins of a typical book. Now, this is something you did in 2015, but you've updated it. Tell us what a book costs. Take us through the process.
Oh, well, I won't try and bore you with too many of the details, but essentially there are all kinds of costs involved in producing a book. I mean, most obviously there are the print costs, and these have more than doubled since that, what now looks like a halcyon pre-Brexit time. And with the kind of numbers that we're doing, we're looking at costs of £2.50 to £3 per unit with the print costs, compared to £1 to £1.50 per unit back in 2015. And then there are all kinds of other costs, like, you know, cover design costs. Those have almost doubled for us, from £600 to £1,000. Typesetting costs, typesetting the invisible but crucial art of putting words on the page and making them look readable and beautiful, that's gone up on average from £300 to £500. And then there are all the other things involved in running a business. And I'm sure an awful lot of your listeners will know that so many things in life have gone up in recent years, you know, electricity, everything else. So it's become increasingly difficult.
Mm. And then, of course, the next part of the process is you're then getting these books into bookshops, and all the booksellers want a discount.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, of course they do, because they've got to make their money as well. But they ask for a lot. In short, you know, we're looking at 50 to 55%. If we're lucky, if bookshops buy in bigger numbers, that's wonderful. But then they start asking for even bigger discounts. So essentially, more than half of the cover price of a book disappears right away when you're selling to bookshops.
And bookshops do it on sale or return. So even if the book's gone into the shop, it may yet come back to you.
Yeah, that's right. We have this very strange thing here in the UK that's essentially a hangover from the Second World War, when there were paper shortages, that bookshops can return the books they don't sell, and then you have to pay some of the money back to them. So, you know, that can really take a big chunk out of what you thought were going to be your profits.
Mm. And tell us about distributors and their teams of representatives, because that costs. What are they doing exactly, and how much does it cost?
It's essentially breaks down about 25% again of the price. They're doing a lot of work for us. I mean, it's not like they don't earn their money. They do the logistics of getting the books into the shops. So that involves the warehousing, the lorries going up and down the country, all of this complicated stuff that, you know, moving physical goods in the world is not easy. But they do a lot more than that. They also represent us to the bookshops. They have all kinds of conversations with them. They're the ones who get our books in front of booksellers, essentially, and persuade them to take them on and to, you know, to get them interested. And, you know, they're this vital part of the chain before the other really vital part where booksellers press the books into readers' hands. So we desperately need them.
What about royalties for authors?
Yeah, again, if listeners are keeping up, you'll be hearing, you know, that more and more of the cover price is disappearing. And of course, authors have to be paid. It's absolutely vital. And, you know, that's why we're here. Eloise and myself, you know, we are writers too. So we are very keen that authors get a fair shake. So, they have to have royalties, which, you know, there are all kinds of complications in how they're paid. But essentially, for us, we have an escalating royalty system, which for the first 3,000 copies, the authors are sold, given 10% of the net price. So that's after various discounts and things. Then it goes up to 12.5% on 5,000, 15% when they sell over 5,000, because, you know, they're on an escalator, because that takes into account all of those production costs I was talking about before, and the cost of designing the covers and all of those things. So once they sell more, we can afford to give them more. You know, and we love paying our authors, but again, it takes away from the profit margin.
So the bottom line, what are publishers making? Per book, obviously it varies, but what would you say is the usual profit, or indeed loss?
Sometimes it does work out as a loss. So the figures we've gone through, and we've put them up on our website if people want to look at them in more detail. And essentially, we're looking at losing up to 46 pence per copy sold and gaining up to 21 pence. So, you know, somewhere in there is where things fall. But as you can see, that's not a lot of money. And it's the other thing is it's considerably less than in 2015. So the range in 2015 was plus 43 pence to plus 93 pence, which is a considerable difference.
That's extraordinary, Sam. 21p per book at your upper limit. What makes you carry on doing it?
You know, we have other ways of making things work, essentially. So we do all kinds of add-on classes and things relating to our website. I teach a very enjoyable class I call it critical reading. It's like a kind of book group, and people pay to do that. And, you know, so there are fringe things that help us keep going. And also, there's always the hope of the big success. And things do change when you're printing in bigger numbers, when you're able to sell rights around the world. And so, you know, we have those things that boost us and support the other books as well.
Sam, thank you. That was so informative. Really, really interesting. And people can see those figures, as you say, on your website. That's the Galley Beggar Press website. And of course, they can pre-order books and buy the ones you have out already.
Yes. And that makes a huge difference to us as well. I mean, it's really important that people go into bookshops and support those too. That's a vital part of our ecosystem. But when people buy direct from us, sometimes that also gives us a boost, because then, of course, we and our authors get a bigger chunk of that cover price.
Absolutely. Sam Jordanson, co-founder of Galley Beggar Press, many thanks to you. Charles, are you thoroughly depressed now?
Those numbers were really sobering. And we are so fortunate that there are people who are still dedicated to this art and to this pursuit that seems to be so shrinkingly remunerated. I'm encouraged, though, to generally read and to generally see that books in print and bookstores are making a bit of a comeback. And hopefully that spells a bit of a turnaround for the fortunes of publishers. But that sort of glimpse inside his economics was really, really, really bracing.
And of course, it's not just books, it's also newspapers. Now, we're huge exponents here of print media. We love the printed word in its physical form. But it's harder and harder for some newspapers to stay afloat. Now, you found one particular paper in Brazil that's facing problems.
That's right. This is a really poignant story and a fascinating one in the Japan Times today, under the headline, Brazil's Last Japanese Language Newspaper Innovates to Stay in Print. And you may be scratching your head briefly thinking, why are there Japanese language newspapers in Brazil? Brazil is home to the world's largest Japanese emigre community. And the Japan Times tells us that there are some 2.7 million Japanese immigrants and their descendants in Brazil, primarily concentrated in the town of São Paulo and primarily concentrated in a neighborhood called Liberdade. I've been to Liberdade and I've been to the Museum of Brazilian Japanese Culture and History, and it started in the beginning of the 1900s when Brazil had an acute requirement for agricultural workers, and there was a massive migration from Japan to Brazil to meet those needs. And at one point, the Japan Times tells us, Brazil was home to a number of Japanese language print newspapers. They have had varying fortunes. There was a time when, during World War II, Japanese language newspapers were banned in Brazil because they were feared as being outlets for propaganda. One of the remaining newspapers in Brazil closed as a result of the pandemic. And so now we have a newspaper called the Diario Brasil Nipo is the last one standing. And what they're trying to do is raise money and develop a more intimate relationship with their readers to stay afloat. And they're looking not just for subscribers among their readers, they're looking for sponsors. And so you, as a reader of this newspaper, can become a member. And you can, you know, you send a little bit of extra money, but then you get access to special editions and you get to place little sort of advertorials in the newspaper, perhaps on a personal matter or on a business matter or congratulating somebody on something like that. And so they're trying to tie themselves closer to the community to stay afloat.
Wonderful to see various innovative ways of trying to do this.
Well, exactly. And the interesting thing is, and there's this great picture of the editor-in-chief of the newspaper holding up this just massive, gigantic, traditional broadsheet newspaper that is rammed with print from edge to edge and from side to side. And they're hoping to get a little bit of government help from Japan, a little bit of government help perhaps, they hope, from Brazil. But mostly it is going to this community in São Paulo and saying, look, we represent you, we reflect you, and we want to engage with you. So, you know, please return this and help us maintain the sense of community that the Japanese migrants have in Brazil.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. That's all we've got time for today. That's it for Monocle on Saturday for this week. Thanks to our producer and studio engineer, Mariella Bevan. And of course, thanks to Charles Hecker and earlier to Sam Jordanson from Galley Beggar Press. Monocle on Saturday will return at the same time next weekend. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.